about homosexuality.
We're also out of time, by the way.
Quickly, I refer to some of the papers and articles which are written and published. I think our dear listeners can also search for that. For example, when it comes to the, two men who are homosexual, it's been proved that such relationship would bring many, illnesses like, some viral diseases like
HIV, I believe it started.
Yeah, HIV,
in such a way.
Syphilis, and other sexually transmitted diseases. It's been proved in the science that they are and also not only about these physical diseases, when it comes to psychological problems, it's been proved in psychology that such relationship between two men and two women, it will bring
damaging.
About many psychological problems and illnesses, and that is why, gradually speaking, it's been proved that many of them later would have, inclination toward isolation from the society.
Depression.
And many other illnesses. I mean, we're not going to talk about that part. I think people can search for that in published books.
Dear Sheikh, I am sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I thank you, dear Sheikh, for sharing with us your knowledge, and also thank you, dear listeners. If our dear listeners, they are interested in further researching this subject, there are many resources, Islamic sources that you can find on the internet, and also ask your local sheikh. And with that, until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Communique.
As Yemen marks the 7th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led bombings, there's a silent killer in Yemen that no one is talking about, the blockade. The Saudi-led coalition has imposed a siege on Yemen, preventing fuel ships from docking in the port of Hodeidah. This has caused fuel prices to skyrocket. People can't afford cooking gas, electricity. The country's inflation has gone ballistic, and the poorest country on earth is being forced to pay hundreds of millions of dollars extra for fuel for absolutely no reason. Now, the Saudis claim that there is no embargo on Yemen. They say that Yemenis are free to import food and all sorts of commodities, but the part that they leave out is that they're not letting Yemenis import fuel. And when there are fuel shortages, the entire economy goes down the drain. Now, what I'm about to show you here is a presentation of my own independent investigative journalism in partnership with a Yemeni economist. He graduated from Oxford and worked at the World Bank. His name is Amir Al-Tiba, and he put together this report which shows the true extent of the Saudi embargo. This is the silent killer that no one is talking about, the silent killer that is destroying Yemen, and we're going to expose it right now. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. So before we go any further, as I said, this is an independent investigation which we released on our own. All of the data in this report, which was put together by Oxford economist Amir Al-Tiba, comes from places like the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and other international organizations. This is on purpose to avoid anyone accusing the report or the data of being biased. And actually, that leads to the numbers being deflated. These are conservative estimates. Now, this information is, of course, very damning to Saudi Arabia, to the United States, to its allies and its backers, and people will try to discredit it. They'll try to attack its integrity. So in order to avoid just that, the data has been sourced from purely unbiased, objective international association. So just a brief recap of the situation. Yemen has been at war for 7 years, right? It's March 23rd, 2015, when Saudi Arabia begins its bombing campaign. And as a result, Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. 17.4 million people, so the majority of Yemen's population, are food insecure. According to UNICEF, 20 million of Yemenis live in extreme poverty. Yemen experienced one of the world's worst cholera epidemics in recent history, with over 2.5 million cases. All the bombings, the famine, the disease, the destruction have led the UN to describe the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Now, the majority of Yemenis live in areas that are controlled by the government in Sana'a. In the West, they often refer to this government as the Houthis or Ansar Allah. The Saudi coalition, on the other hand, support the government in Aden, which was deposed in a coup. Now, this is officially, it's the internationally recognized government, even though it lacks popular support. And that's who Saudi Arabia, that's who the UAE, that's who the United States have been backing. And it's in order to crush the Sana'a government, where, again, it's under their jurisdiction that most Yemenis live. This Saudi-led coalition have begun bombing Yemen. Britain and the United States have profited immensely from this genocide. They've sold Saudi Arabia literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons and provide them with training and logistical support. You know, just this January, the Saudis bombed a prison, killing 70 people. They even disabled the entire country's internet after destroying vital infrastructure in the port city of Hodeidah. Now this week, as we said, marks 7 years since the start of the bombing campaign. People gathered in Yemen to mark a national day of resistance and show their resolve, show their resilience in the face of all this adversity. And right now, you know, what people are talking about is the fact that Yemen hit a petroleum storage facility in Saudi Arabia belonging to Aramco. This happened as the Formula One Grand Prix is taking place. And of course, while the photographs and the videos from that certainly make for interesting headlines and front pages, there is a much bigger story about Yemen that doesn't receive anywhere near as much attention. So let's say you're a fuel tanker, right? And you want to bring gasoline or you want to bring diesel to Yemen to sell it. Well, what do? First, you need to obtain permission from the United Nations Verification and Inspection Mechanism for Yemen, UNVIM. So this was set up to inspect vessels and their cargo. Ships headed to Yemen, they got to stop first in Djibouti. And once they pass inspection, they're issued a clearance certificate. Now, the issue is that right before they get to Hudaydah, to the port city of Hudaydah in Yemen, the Saudi Navy start detaining these ships, despite the fact that they already have clearance from the UN, right? So once they get close to Yemen, the Saudi Navy stops them and they take them to the so-called coalition holding area in the Red Sea. Now, obviously, randomly detaining ships voids the entire purpose of the UN verification. And not only that, but by detaining these fuel ships, the price of fuel goes up. Because if you fail to offload a ship's cargo, that prevents the owner of the ship from using the vessel to do other business, right? So they start losing money. And then you have to pay the owner of the chartered ship a fine. This is also known as a demurrage cost. And so in 2020, the total amount of demurrage fines because of the Saudis detaining fuel ships on the way to Yemen was $85 million. The next year, in 2021, it was $24.5 million. Now, at first sight, you might be thinking, well, that's an improvement, right? $24.5 million is a lot less than $85 million. But no, you'd be wrong. It's not an improvement. As a matter of fact, the situation got worse. In 2020, a gasoline or diesel ship will be delayed for around 61 days on average. In 2021, a ship could be expected to be detained for 85 days. So the annual average demurrage costs for just one vessel went up from $1.14 million to $1.65 million. That's a 44 percent increase from 2020 to 2021 on average for every ship. And who pays for this in the end? Yemenis. Yemenis, of course, at the market, at the pump. And so the only reason that the total dollar amount of demurrage fines went down from 2020 to 2021 is ironically because less ships started coming into Yemen, right? People became reluctant to even attempt bringing fuel there because it's just so difficult. So many vessels that were originally planning to go to Yemen ended up going back or docking instead in neighboring countries and selling their cargo there. And so you can see from this table how year by year, the costs get higher and higher. In 2019, the annual average demurrage costs per one ton of gasoline is around $16. Then $49 in 2020, then $165 in 2021. So in 2019, you know, a gasoline ship would be held for 23 days on average. And then in 2021, 219 days. I mean, think about that. That's almost an entire year that a fuel ship is not allowed to move, not allowed to offload its cargo. And in some cases, there are indeed ships that have been held over a year. 219 days is just the average. And so once the ships actually reach Yemen, it gets worse. Because with this blockade, they can't go to Hodeidah port, right? So instead, they have to go offload their cargo either in Adan or in Mukalla. So in ports that are under control of the Saudi-backed government. Now, not only are these ports further away from Hodeidah, but they also slap the fuel ships with higher costs. The customs fees, commissions to the refineries, security fees, intermediary office fees, higher transport costs, transport damages, all of this adds up like you would not believe. And so if you look at the table, you see that in November 2021, this adds up to $410 extra for every ton of gasoline and $317 extra for every ton of diesel. Okay, so that's we're talking $410 for every ton of gasoline, $317 for every ton of diesel, extra than if they had just gone to Hodeidah. So again, just look at this detour, because once the fuel trucks get going from Hodeidah to Sana'a, it's just 226 kilometers distance. Or let's say Aden to Hodeidah, which is usually a 430 kilometer drive. But now the fuel trucks have to take this enormous detour. So this obviously increases the cost of transportation so much because the trucks have to travel a further distance, increase their fuel consumption and other incurred fees and potential breakage costs. So again, just to recap, the fuel ships come to ports controlled by the Saudi-backed government. They have to pay higher taxes, then higher transportation costs because the journey is longer. And on top of that, you have the roadblocks. So all along this yellow route, you have various militias, various armed groups, including Al-Qaeda, that set up checkpoints. And so when the fuel trucks try to pass, they shake them down for money, right? If the drivers don't pay up, they get killed. And so other militias that are also affiliated with the Southern Transitional Council are involved. You know, one checkpoint will add 5% to the pump price, another 10% here, another 5% there. And so you've got about 50 checkpoints with groups that are looking to make a quick buck. And who pays for this? Again, it's the Yemeni civilians who have to pay the cost, the incurred cost at the pump. So because of all these obstacles, because of this embargo, you know, people are discouraged to bring fuel ships at all to Yemen. So in 2020, you had a total of 73 ships that brought fuel to Hodeidah. The following year, 5 ships. 5 fuel ships came to Hodeidah in 2021. That is a 60% decrease. Do you know how many fuel ships have come so far to Hodeidah this year in 2022? One. Literally just one. So not only is the fuel in Yemen more expensive, but it's not even enough. It doesn't suffice. And so when it comes to oil derivatives, there was a deficit of 49% in local consumption. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that Yemenis only consumed half the oil that they actually need in all of 2020. Okay? So in 2020, Yemen needed 1.3 million metric tons of gasoline. They only got half, a 49% deficit in gasoline and diesel. In 2021, a 90% deficit, 90. So even if Yemenis could afford the oil, there's not enough coming in. And so like all countries that are impacted by sanctions, this embargo has led to the creation of a black market. And while the official prices for oil are low, well, there simply isn't any oil to sell. That means that consumers have to turn to the black market, where price gouging is rampant. People are forced to pay several times over what they normally would out of pure necessity. So just to give you an idea how bad this is, during the first 5 months of 2021, the price of oil on the black market went up 90% each month on average. So again, look at this graph. You can see the monthly average of gasoline prices in Sana'a per liter per riyal. And you can see the monthly average of diesel prices as well. And so in the first 5 months of 2021, the price on the black market, which is in red, it just climbs and climbs and climbs and keeps climbing. Now you can imagine what this increase, this steep increase in fuel prices ends up doing to the people in Yemen, to Yemen's agriculture, Yemen's industry, Yemen's service sectors. This also means that you end up with oil derivatives that are of poorer quality because they're not controlled by the authorities. So they not only cost more, but they're also damaging the environment. They're damaging the consumers. They're damaging property and equipment. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Amir El-Tibah is the Yemeni economist who compiled all of this data, who did this brilliant job. He helped me put together this report. Amir studied in the United Kingdom. He's an Oxford graduate, and he used to work at the World Bank. He's been a country economist for almost 30 years now. He's based in Sana'a, and we spoke earlier about this report and the effects of the siege in more detail. Amir, thank you for coming on the program and taking the time to sit down and go through this with me. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure and honor to speak to you.
Amir, let's start from the beginning. Let's explain the chain of events. Basically, there are ships that are carrying fuel coming to Yemen, but they don't actually come straight to Yemen. They get stopped first. Why do they get stopped?
First, we will have to say, I mean, this is commercial imports are done by the private sector. So the public sector here, the government, have no foreign reserves or hard currencies, and they cannot finance the import bill. So everything has to be done through the private sector. And then, in order to qualify or to be able to submit or to purchase a fuel vessel, you have to first, pay for the 100% in advance for the cost of the shipment. Once the importer, overcomes these restrictions, the fuel will be purchased from the UAE. This is one of the facts that kept from the public. Once the fuel departs from UAE and heads to Yemen, to Hodeidah port, it gets redirected to Djibouti port, where the fuel has to be inspected and verified by the UN verification inspection mechanism. This is a new body, a UN body, which was created as a result of the Security Council resolutions. And there, the fuel and the entire the paperwork for the vessel and the content of the vessel will be inspected. And after that, once the fuel is inspected and cleared by the UN, the fuel would leave the port of the vessel would leave the port of Djibouti, heading towards Hodeidah. And there, the vessel will be stopped and detained by warships of the coalition, and then taken to detention area near Jazan port in Saudi Arabia. There, there is always an excuse or a justification for why ships are detained. Each day would add $20,000 worth of delay or demurrage fees onto the final cost of the fuel. Some of them are permitted to enter Hodeidah eventually, but then only when the cost, the total cost of the fuel is much, much more than the real cost of, that day. This had huge consequences on the prices. I mean, we've had a severe fuel shortages and very flourishing black markets for smuggled fuel throughout, I mean, during the conflict since 2015. But last year, the problem became much, much worse. To put it in figures, last year, only five ships were allowed to enter Hodeidah eventually throughout. I mean, five fuel vessels of diesel and gas.
So basically, you end up with a situation where the necessary fuel consumption for the whole year, only a tiny fraction is actually coming through Hodeidah, but the majority is coming through the land ports, right? And who controls the land ports?
This was not very common before 2021, but since 2021, suddenly, because vessels would not be allowed to enter through Hodeidah, and then, you know, this would eventually create so much resentments and frustration by the public, in addition to the suffering and shutdowns and suspensions by several sectors in the economy. So eventually, I think starting from April last year, the authorities here started to regulate and allow fuel supply from Aden and from other ports controlled by the government in Aden. Eventually, this, you know, the additional cost added onto this fuel was not big, but it just gradually increased and became bigger and bigger until now, you know, the added cost amounts to almost 60% more than the cost of fuel imported through Hodeidah.
Right.
So this is an additional inflationary effect, which has an impact on everything. But also because of, you know, the inflated cost of transport and because of this roadblocks, where you know each fuel tanker will have to be stopped and will have to pay informal levies to mostly armed militia groups. Some are affiliated with the government in Aden, some are not. And this is not, I mean, this is not really shocking or surprising or a new phenomenon. I mean, we've seen this in South Sudan, we've seen it in so many different countries. It's really financing and providing finances to armed groups, which will definitely prolong prolong the conflict and fuel the fuel violence throughout Yemen. So
does that include Al Qaeda as well?
Absolutely. I mean, this is not. I mean, this has been recognized and publicized by activists in the north and the south.
In the report, we saw that in 2021. The direct financial losses because of this increase in oil prices and oil derivatives, you know, gasoline and diesel, was $644.4 million. So, I mean, just to get this straight, does that mean that people in Yemen in 2021, they paid an extra $644 million, or because of this increase in oil prices and the lack of oil, it caused the infrastructure and the state and businesses to lose money? Just to be clear,
this is how much the population, not the entire population even. I mean, this is how much the population under the in areas and markets controlled by the Sana market. We're talking about 25 million, between 23 to 25 million people paid, you know, as an addition on their fuel prices. So this is not counting the damage estimates or financial losses in direct or indirect suffered by the economy or the infrastructure. This is how much the citizens of the poorest people in the world had to pay extra to get their fuel in 2021.
I wanted to talk to you about the difference in prices. We can see how in Riyal, the price of oil and oil derivatives is completely wild. We have a Su'al Aswad, which is the black market. We have Tijara, which Tijari, which is the private sector in this case, and then Rasmi, which is the official price. My understanding was that the official price, it stayed low for as long as it could, but there's no oil. And then in the black market, there is oil, but the price skyrockets, of course, and then you have a lot of people making money off of that, right?
Yes. So the official price, this is for fuel imported through Hodeidah. And this is the most affordable and source for fuel, even before the current restrictions. The commercial fuel, or the commercial price, is for fuel which is sourced from the port of Aden or Mukalla. So this is supplied by land, but imported by the private sector through the port of Aden and other ports controlled by the government in Aden. And just to add another fact. Now, the blockade and this inspection and verification mechanism for Hodeidah port, this is only covered for Hodeidah port. But if you are importing fuel or any commodities through other Aden-controlled ports, there is no such a thing. So you don't have to go through this very long and costly process. You don't have to be detained. You don't have to pay extra money for delay. And the irony of this is that most of the smuggling, including smuggled fuel, comes from those territories that are not under any supervision. And this is just another aspect of this politicized blockade.
This siege has resulted in a decline in purchasing power of Yemeni households, who are now left unable to cover their basic necessities even more than before, from electricity to cooking gas. In Yemen, there are 0 hours of electricity. What most people have to get are solar panels or private grids, and the cost is astronomical. That cost is directly linked to the cost of fuel in the black market. In a statement, the Federation of Yemeni Private Hospitals said that, quote, blocking fuel from entering Yemen has caused the death of many patients in intensive care units, emergency and operations departments, as well as the hospital's inability to save and store medicines for chronic diseases. Now, every year a donor conference is held and all these countries get together. This year they actually couldn't even meet the goal that they had pledged to help Yemen. You know, they keep throwing money at the problem, but this doesn't fix anything. The inflation in Yemen has skyrocketed to not 1%, not 10%, 40% in 2021. Agriculture, industry, service sector, everything has been disrupted. Everything is more expensive as a direct result. And the Saudi-backed government appears to have a vested interest in blocking fuel shipments to Hodeidah. It gets to tax the population, and then on the flip side, provide Yemenis with nothing, right? They claim to be the legitimate government of Yemen, and they're in charge of all the reserves, the crude, the central bank, and yet they pay no public salaries. You know, they move the central back to Aden, but pay no salaries to public employees and servants. They pay no public salaries, but want to tax the population nonetheless. Now, there's no question, the bombings in Yemen need to stop immediately. And the aid is good, but it won't solve the crisis. What Yemen needs is for the siege to be lifted. This siege is man-made, it's completely unnecessary, and killing Yemenis on an unimaginable scale. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, around 230,000 people in Gaza were unemployed during 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Amjad Ayman Yaqi Ryder. This article is published under the heading, No Rights for Gaza's Workers in Occupied Territories. Here's more. Mohammed Abdul Wahab had an accident while working on a construction site in the occupied territories. His injury was severe, hemorrhaging from a wound to the head, and he went to a clinic. The clinic advised him to go to hospital, but Abdul Wahab preferred to wait and return to Gaza for treatment. Since he did not have health insurance, treatment would have been too expensive in the Palestinian occupied territories. Despite the severity of Abdul Wahab's injury, his employer did not provide any financial compensation or medical treatment. Abdul Wahab, 39, is a father of four and lives in Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza Strip. He had been unemployed for 3 years when he started working construction jobs in the occupied territories in December 2021. His accident occurred in February this year. Although he is a professional blacksmith, Abdul Wahab did not mind working in any field in the occupied territories, not only because those jobs paid relatively well, but because the Zionist regime's blockade on Gaza, imposed in 2007, has severely diminished job opportunities in the strip. Abdul Wahab was able to obtain a permit to work in the occupied territories, but he was not officially designated a worker. Instead, he received a financial needs permit, which strips the worker of access to benefits like workers' compensation, health insurance, and other labor rights afforded to workers in the occupied territories, he said. I'm waiting to recover from my injury to return to work. The more I stay at home, the more things get worse for me. I have children, three of them are school students, and I have major expenses. Though Abdul Wahab considers matters like health and life insurance important, he said that conditions in Gaza are so dire that any job, even one without benefits, is like a dream. In this, Abdul Wahab is taking into consideration his children's futures, which seem in peril when he and his co-workers lack job security. The Zionist regime recently granted an additional 8,000 permits to Palestinian workers from the Gaza Strip to work inside the occupied territories. Yet, due to the nature of these permits, these workers lack labor and social benefits and are treated differently and often paid less than Palestinian workers from the occupied West Bank. Instead of labor permits, the workers from Gaza are granted financial needs permits that do not guarantee them labor rights. Workers from the West Bank, meanwhile, have fixed permits. Fahmi Amin, 40, who works in an Israeli regime factory near Gaza, said obtaining such permits can cost a Palestinian in Gaza up to $1,000 in registration fees to Gaza's finance ministry, a huge amount for the unemployed. Yet many are held and questioned by the Zionist regime's authorities for brief periods at Erez checkpoint, the sole crossing for people between Gaza and the occupied territories. Amin said that he and other workers would work anywhere so long as they can provide food and clothing for their children. Following the Zionist regime's May 2021 attack on Gaza, the Zionist regime authorized an additional 3,000 merchant permits for Palestinians in Gaza bringing the total number of permits to 10,000. Yet these merchant and financial needs permits do not entail labor rights. Up until the outbreak of the Second Intifada in 2000, the total number of workers from Gaza inside the occupied territories stood at nearly 30,000. Today, this number does not exceed 10,000 Palestinian workers from Gaza, according to Sami Al-Masi, head of the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions in Gaza. Al-Amasi pointed out that Israelis, by refusing to label Palestinians from Gaza as workers, evade any commitment to providing labor and financial rights. Many workers who were injured or fired before 2000, Al-Amasi said, sought out Palestinian lawyers with Israeli citizenship to obtain their rights. Some of these cases remained in the courts for years, as the Zionist regime employers sought to deny Palestinian workers their rights. Al-Amasi explained that the Zionist regime replaced merchant permits with financial needs permits to avoid providing workers with health insurance, compensation in case of injury, and severance pay. Al-Amasi noted that before 2000, Gazans employed in the occupied territories were granted the title of worker. Everyone should be granted the status of worker, he said, so that everyone gets his due rights. The union he represents is now pushing for at least 30,000 permits to be issued for people from Gaza to work in the occupied territories. These efforts are being assisted by what Al-Amasi called intermediaries. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, around 230,000 people in Gaza were unemployed during 2021. Among Palestinians with diplomas aged 19 to 29 in Gaza Strip, 66% of females were unemployed and 39% of males. Maher Al-Taba, the director of Gaza's Chamber of Commerce, said that the merchant and financial needs permits issued to Palestinians in Gaza do not afford them any rights. Yet the workers accept these limits, he said, due to high rates of poverty and unemployment in the Gaza Strip. He added that the Zionist regime may later use this as a way to pressure Palestinian factions into accepting a long-term armistice with the Zionist regime, which was not taken into account during the earlier negotiations brokered by Egypt. Currently, the workers who have permits have very limited impact on Gaza's economy, when compared to previous years, Al-Taba said, the number of people seeking jobs far outweighs the number of permits available. The minimum wage in Gaza is less than $600 per month, yet the actual average monthly wage is $200. Low wages are prominent in besieged Gaza, Al-Taba said, adding that very few public and private institutions are able to pay the minimum wage. Even then, he noted, it is limited to major institutions such as banks and main telecom companies, while other workers in Gaza receive half or less than half of minimum wage.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope. Toward the peak. On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم brothers and sisters dear listeners السلام عليكم ورحمته وبركاته and welcome to Youth Station my dear beautiful listeners wherever you might be if you're standing sit down if you're sitting stand up with me sister Asma السلام عليكم Asma how are you sister
thank you السلام عليكم brother excellent. So what are we going to discuss today
let's talk about addiction
I'm addicted to so many things. Are
who
you?
Is not?
Are you?
Is there what anyone are you addicted who could to? What is there are anyone who could Let claim that I'm life. Not addicted to anything?
You're not?
Yes, I am, of
oh,
course.
Oh, you are?
I said,
okay, I had just the word not. And I'm like, what is she, a saint?
No.
Okay,
no,
so what are you addicted
I am
to?
Addicted. I am addicted to using so much of social media.
Who isn't? I'm guilty.
I'm addicted to what more? Overthinking. I'm addicted to overthinking.
Is that an addiction?
Yes, it's an
addiction. Oh, can we have like a good addiction, bad addiction?
Is that a good addiction to be overthinking?
No, I mean, like, can we even have bad addiction?
Yes, of course we could have good addiction.
But, I mean, isn't the word addiction, it's like it has like a negative vibe
yes,
to it?
Yes, yes. It has some negative connotations.
Can we attach it to something that's good?
But sometimes there are good addictions. For example, reading books is a good addiction.
Mm.
But nowadays, since we have cell phones in our hands.
I mean, is reading books considered to be addiction or just seeking knowledge?
No, you know,
unless you want to say seeking knowledge is addictive.
No. Also, that is addictive. We could say
or
that.
Or maybe parts of reading. Because, like, if, for example, I'm addicted to reading novels. Mm-hmm. Novels not necessarily the
That's my
thing.
Job. I'm addicted to reading novels. So good addictions we have as well. But bad addictions are the ones that are going to kill us one day.
Mm. So far, we can have good addiction mm-hmm. and bad
yes.
addiction. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know. Are we doing more of the good addiction or the bad addiction?
It depends.
As youth.
Depends.
As
youth.
What, yeah, what are we doing?
What everyone would say right now is bad addiction.
Bad addiction?
Yes. If you call the parents, then they would say bad addictions.
Bad addiction from the perspective of the parents or from the perspective of the youth? Now, for example, as a young
person. No, the perspective of the youth, there is no bad addiction.
Right. So do you call playing video games as an addiction?
It's an addiction, yes.
All right, so if I play video games, I mean, as a young person, I don't have much to do,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yes.
I got plenty
Your
of time.
Your parents would call that addiction, bad addiction, but you would call it a hobby.
Yeah, so I got a lot of time to kill, so why would it be addiction?
Because after some points in your life, that would turn to be one of your habits, and you cannot live without it. You know, everything is good, whatever you're doing and you consider it good, it's good, but until the time it's not in a way that if you don't do it, you feel something is missing in your life. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, okay. Something was just like when you first say something, something clicked in my head and I just drifted away. Is habit and addiction synonymous to each other?
They could be.
Yeah, like, oh, they just two different words with two different meanings.
Of course, every single word has got a meaning for itself. It speaks of its own, but I would say habits and addictions are... Habits, after a while, would turn into addiction.
So it could work vice versa.
Yes.
Habit could be an addiction. Addiction could be a habit.
Yes, yes.
All right, cool.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Do you have any other ideas?
So I don't know.
You say that habits are not addictions?
Am I saying habits are not addictions? I don't know, but I'm getting the sense that an addiction is a very strong word to a habit. An addiction is like something you can't live without. For example, if someone is on drug. He's got drug addiction. He can't live without that kind of addiction. Or someone is like addicted to social media.
Mm-hmm.
They addicted. You take the phone away from them and they've blown your face. Where a habit is just something that, for example, praying. Salah becomes a habit. You know, like if, you know how the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, he said, tell me about this man. He's constantly praying.
Yes.
And he said, well, test him. You know, test some other thing he says.
So habits are like addictions.
No, I'm saying. So a person can live without, you know what I mean? Like a
yes,
habit.
Yes, I know.
I can live without a habit. It's like, okay, my habit is to
but
do this on time.
But it has been a part
but
of
let's say,
you.
For example, if I don't have the right environment, right time, I can get away with it. You know, like, okay, it's just a habit. But if it's an addiction, like I start to itch, like I must have it. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you
like,
mean.
I will die without it. Like try to take an iPhone or like, you know, a device from a young kid or from an adult from doing something they do, they wouldn't know what to do. Like, get them for the kids just to play 8 8 hours a day.
Well, as for me, I would say I would not live without my habits as well. So the, for me, okay. habits
so
are
you
the
told
same.
One of your habits is reading books, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what happens if one day I say to your sister, Asma, let's go do some work, and you don't get to read your book for a whole day?
Well,
how would
let's
you
say
feel?
It's
do
my
feel,
addiction.
Do you feel like withdrawal?
Well, that would be very difficult because I feel like something is missing.
No.
My plans are not going as they were.
I'm saying the word addiction, mm-hmm. it has like a lot of symptoms with it, right?
Yes.
And a lot of withdrawals mm-hmm. if you don't do it. For example, addicted to smoking. You don't yes. smoke for a day and you start to go crazy. You take your drugs
so
and you go crazy.
So do we have a person of having the habit of smoking? We could say that someone has a habit of smoking.
No, you can't because habit, like what? My habit is to smoke? No, it's an actual addiction because mm-hmm. addiction is when your brain neurons and the way your brain
thinks.
So
you are putting too much stress on the word addiction. Just no, say it like habit. Habit addiction.
No,
then
you
that,
can't.
The story is
no,
told.
You can't because this way you're misleading the youth. Because you know what? A youth could come to you and be like, no, it's just a habit. Like they will try to lower the full extent of mm-hmm. the word. Right, they go into something that's really bad. Oh, it's just a habit. Which
yes,
means
it's
like, you know,
just a habit.
No. If it's a really bad thing, if it's an addiction and you call it habit, for example, why isn't the medical science referring to things as habits? Okay, smoking is a habit. Overeating is a habit. Everything is a habit. It might begin as a habit.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Turns into addiction. Once it turns into addiction, mm-hmm. it's a disease. It's no longer... Because anything, like I said from the beginning, that word addiction has a negative vibe to it. Anything that's addicted or you become addicted to mm-hmm. is obviously not good for you.
Of course.
Yeah, so we'll
But say, all the addictions start with habits.
They start with habits.
Yes.
Right, yeah. But can we call them habits? That's what I think me and you, we might not 100% agree there.
Yes.
Yeah, because like I said, with a if a person has a habit, they can give it up. They can mm-hmm. leave it without any withdrawal, without any medication.
I don't have the same thoughts on that. Yeah. Habits are also very difficult.
They're strong, not saying that, you know, they're strong. Like you feel something empty, like you said. For example, with people who are addicted to something, mm-hmm. if you don't give it to them, some people become very violent. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like
yes.
I've seen a lot of kids, like they start mm-hmm. to yell and scream at their parents. I've seen adults, like even adults, so not even youth, if you take something that they're addicted to, they
become so aggressive.
They're aggressive. They sometimes even commit murder.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
So it gets out of hand. So that's why, like today, you know, the medical science arena kind of thing, they're trying to very much try to deal with addictions, which is a problem.
And it's
like
very
gambling
difficult
addiction,
to deal with,
drug
you know?
Addiction, alcohol addiction,
mm-hmm, yes.
And now we have social media addiction. Australia, we have dedicated centers now to gaming addiction.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah, so where parents bringing their kids, like, okay, my child is addicted.
And does that work?
It does work, yeah. They put them through programs and stuff like that. It works. So, you know, they change a lot of things in their life, like their foods, their stuff. They take them out. They mm-hmm. like they would have certain programs that keeps them
They
occupied.
Replace other
they,
activities.
Yeah, they kind of get their mind back to a normal state where they're not
back
no
to
longer
reality.
Back to reality. So they're no longer. But that's a problem, though. We have the meta things
Metaverse,
coming. Metaverse
yes,
coming. That's
yes.
going to be a problem.
That's going to make it deeper
We're
and deeper.
To bring people back to reality. They putting them back into, what do you call it?
They take them forth into future. So we were talking about metaverse that is going to take us into a new world, which uh-huh. is going to be more addictive.
Okay, so we want to bring them back to reality.
Yes.
They want to take them into virtual reality, which is not real. That's
yes.
the word I'm after. Virtual
yes.
reality. Where we live in a virtual reality now, where everything doesn't seem to be realistic mm-hmm. enough. And we seem to enjoy it. So if this metaverse comes in and they want to say, you know what, You don't even need to interact with people anymore. You can just live inside your glasses and talk and do things. That's a problem.
And since it's going to be very interesting, then we are going to put much time on that.
Yeah. Have you watched the TV series called Black Window?
Why? How does it relate to Metaverse and...
Okay, because Black Window, it's a series about how futuristic things could become reality. Like you put a chip on your brain and then your eyes kind of black out and then you just completely got into another like a virtual reality thing where it's very realistic and what you feel in that reality, a virtual reality, your body could actually sense it and feels it too. Which if this becomes a reality, that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
Like if they actually work and develop it. Like, I mean, I know like Facebook is working on the Metaverse, which if it becomes reality, you have millions of people in their glasses instead of being outside.
And then you would sleep on the sofa and then you would have those glasses on your eyes and the life stops.
Exactly. Sorry, I do apologize. It was the series called Black Mirror, not Black Window. Black Mirror.
Yes.
Right?
So I should watch that.
You should. But I mean, like, if this is what we're headed, we can have a problem. So that
of
could
course.
Be
so because
that's an addiction
right now,
because people right now are addicted to Facebook, aren't they?
Yes. We cannot solve this addiction. Now a bigger addiction comes in.
Yeah, so the addiction itself is kind of evolving.
Yes,
from
it's evolving.
Just crawling with your fingers. Mm-hmm. Like if for those who are addicted to Facebook, there are those who are addicted to TikTok. There are those who are addicted to YouTube. Those who are addicted to Snapchat.
But there are ways to control it, you know? I remember there was a month when I had to study pretty much stronger than other times. Then what I did was that I devoted a special time. I said, you can have only 1 hour each night to go through social
media. So that's a reward system. You're rewarding yourself.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I said, you do all your jobs, and then after you finish, you would reward yourself in a way that you could go for your cell phone and go through social media. That was the way I healed myself for only a month. And then after that, when everything was smoother.
When you finished
school,
you went back to your addiction.
because I had much more time, you know. What makes things terrible is your free time. If you do not plan for your free time, you get stuck with addiction.
Okay, that's a problem.
There are addictions for you.
Yeah, but then addiction, they fill up your time and you say, I have no time left.
Yes, that's true.
Like, my time is full. I got no time. What are you doing?
Nothing.
I'm just watching TV. I'm just going through Netflix.
I'm doing nothing, yet I'm so busy.
Yeah, I have that disease. Okay.
Yes. May God bless us all.
I mean, Leah, we definitely need to take the addiction seriously, especially when it comes to time. Things that consume our time management, it will have devastating effect on our careers, on our brains, on our families, on our kids. So addiction these days are just, to me, it's just as deadly as cancer.
Exactly.
Because if you're not active, you're just as good as dead. I always remember this saying that one guy said once. He said, if you're not giving extra to life, you are extra on life. So we have millions of people who are extra on life. They're not doing anything good to life, rather than they sucking the life out of life.
Yes, you know what I mean? Unfortunately, sometimes we turn into just beings who are breathing. That's what we do.
That's a big problem. All right.
Yes.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. All right. Thank you guys for listening. Inshallah, we will get back to you in another program. Stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.